My castaway this week is a songwriter. He was born into a poor Jewish family in the East End of London, left school at 15, and found himself drawn, thanks to an apprenticeship on the New Musical Express, into the world of popular music. He's known failure. He was a disastrously unsuccessful comedian at one time, but his unerring ability to write words that stay with you has made him a wealthy man. If you've seen or listened to the musical Sunset Boulevard, Aspects of Love or Billy, or heard the songs Born Free and Diamonds Are Forever and many, many more, then you're already familiar with his work. He's one of this country's most successful lyricists. He is Don Black. It seems to me one of the most frustrating things, Don, about being a lyricist is that if you do the job well, that is to say, you get the lyric right, it's simple, it's concise, it just feels right, then everybody thinks, well, I could have written that, it's easy.
They do. People find it very easy to criticise lyrics. Very few people can say, I hate that B-flat in bar 14, because that's very technical.
But is it like writing a pop song? I mean, I often think when you hear a pop song that's destined to go to number one, you sort of know it, or I used to, I don't know whether I do these days, but you know it when you hear it, it sounds right. And it's the same with lyrics, isn't it? There's a kind of obviousness about it.
Well, it depends what kind of lyrics you're talking about. If you're talking about lyrics in the old days or lyrics today, it's not so much about songs these days, it's more about records. I'm not
sure. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, when I started writing songs, everyone, when I was in Denmark Street in the early days, people used to say, have you heard that great new Sinatra song? Well, these days they say, have you heard that great George Michael record? It's a big difference. When I started writing songs, they were demonstrated with a voice and piano, so you could really dissect it. These days, if you hear a demonstration of a new song, it's like the finished record with all kinds of sounds and synthesizers.
So are you also saying that the words don't matter so much anymore?
Well, they don't matter so much. No, I hate to say that, but I must say it. The words do not matter as much. Every now and again, a song comes through, like a ballad in today's world, and people say, oh, good music's coming back. Because you get a song like The Wind Beneath My Wings or Whitney Houston singing I Will Always Love You, and people say, have you heard that song? That's one of the few times they say, have you heard that song? These days, I very rarely listen to the radio and say, what a fabulous song. It's a shame, but it's true.
But do you still feel you can sit down and write a fabulous song like Born Free or Diamonds Are Forever, if that's what you care to do?
Well, I think times have changed. I mean, to give you an example, you mentioned Born Free. When I won the Academy Award for that in 1967, within a year or so, 600 people recorded it. Now, Tim Rice, who recently won an Oscar for his song from Aladdin, I don't think anyone's recorded it, apart from the original people.
Why not?
Because there aren't those people making records. People who record today are people who sing their own songs, which the Beatles have a lot to answer for that. I don't want to sound too... I'm not bitter about this, but it's just a fact that...
It's just the way it is.
It is. That's the way it is, Sue.
More of that in a minute. Let's get you to this desert island. Tell me about your first record.
Well, my first record is a song called Surrey with the Fringe on Top from Oklahoma, and it's just lyric writing at its best. It's Oscar Hammerstein doing what you're supposed to do. Every word hugs the contours of the melody, it crackles, it fizzes, and Lena Horne doesn't miss a syllable.
Chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when I take you out into Surrey, when I take you out into Surrey with the fringe on top.
Lena Horne and the Surrey with the Fringe on Top from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma. The other great line there, of course, was the corner's as high as an elephant's eye and it looks like it's climbing right up to the sky.
Yeah, he was just so full of imagery, Oscar Hammerstein.
But that's what you have to do, isn't it? You have to just find that image that is, again, as I was saying earlier, very obvious and yet...
And yet, yes, it's sort of saying what people think but can't say. I mean, you look for that. You look for that fresh line. I'm always on red alert, you know, when I'm with people, when I'm with nieces, sisters, especially anyone who's got a troubled relationship. I hate to say this, but I like to hear them pour their heart out a little bit because they may just say a phrase.
Come out with an original phrase.
I mean, if I was in a restaurant and I heard someone at the next table say to someone else, you've lost that loving feeling, I'd write it down.
But someone might have written it down before.
That's right.
How often does it happen then? How often do you come across them?
Well, you don't really, but you come up with an idea. You know, someone, it's like when I wrote Tell Me on a Sunday, you know, it was a friend of mine was going through a bad time, a niece of mine actually, and she was saying, I know it's not going to happen, you know, one day it's going to end, I just hope he does it right. And I thought, hang on a minute, how does she hope it's done? She wants to be taken to a park covered with trees and be told on a Sunday, please. I thought, yeah, well, that's that. I haven't heard that before in another song.
There's that other very good line in that song, wasn't there? Don't call me at 3 a.m. from a friend's apartment.
That's right.
You know, it just kind of sums it all up in a way.
I love songs that start you off straight away with the opening line. There's one coming up later on, which Kenny Rogers song, which he just says, in a bar in Toledo. You don't have to go any further than that. You're there in that bar in Toledo.
It's so just, you like telling a story?
Yes, like particularly straight off. Like by the time I get to Phoenix, you think, oh, hang on, you don't have to say much more than that, you know.
She'll be rising.
And then you're there. You're just in there. You've got that slice of life instantly.
Now, that's for one-off songs.
Mm.
What about for musicals, though? If you sit down with Andrew Lloyd Webber to write Sunset Boulevard, how do you begin?
Well, you pray a lot. But with Andrew Lloyd Webber, he is very much a musical dramatist. He is not like any other songwriter I've worked with, really. The thing about Andrew, he does write a lot before the song begins. Like a Norma Desmond on Sunset Boulevard, he will start playing the piano as she's on top of the stairs, and he'll say, Norma's on the stairs now, and he's playing, and she looks around to Joe Gillis, and now he's playing, now he changes key, and he kind of shoehorns you into the song. Then he'll play With One Look, or La La La.
So he says, he then gives you the gist of it.
Yeah, we talk about it. He's very good at that. He gives all the highs and lows. You think, well...
But when you originally talked about it, you actually had Memory in there, didn't you? I mean,
that's right.
The one that went on to be a big hit in Cats.
In Cats,
well,
yes.
You lost that.
I did lose that. It shows you. Yeah.
Why did that happen?
Because it was at a time, this was in about 1979, when we started it, and we wrote this song for Norma Desmond called A Big Star, it was called, or The Greatest Star of All. And then he went off Sunset Boulevard, went on to do Cats, but he didn't want to waste that marvellous melody. And he was right, wasn't he?
Record number two.
Well, record number two, I thought on this island I should keep myself busy with writing lyrics, so I thought I'd choose one instrumental so I could keep writing words to my heart's content. And I just thought it's a wonderful melody. It's Al Bononi's Adagio in G minor.
Albinoni's Adagio in G minor for organ and strings, played by the London Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Christopher Warren Green. Terribly sad, I'm afraid.
Not really, Sue. I was scribbling some words or thinking of some words while it was playing. I'm talking with Sue Lawley. She's prettier than Sheridan Morley.
That wouldn't keep you interested in that, though, would it?
No, it is full of sorrow and full of pain. That melody is just so full of goosebumps and... Now, I can see myself under some kind of tree, pondering that.
Mm. Tell me about your early life, because apparently you were born of a star-struck mother whose ambition was to be a cinema usherette, is that right?
It was close. I mean, it was, yes, we were very poor. We came from Hackney and happy, all happy, happy. I know it isn't fashionable to talk about happy childhoods particularly, but mine was bliss, and my mother was singing all the time. They both came from Russia, my mother and father, and they just used to sing gypsy songs, flamenco songs, anything with a kind of a Jewish passion. Passion is probably the word I'm looking for. And so when Frankie Lane came on the scene with things like Jezebel and Cry of the Wild Goose, my mother was just over the moon. And her idea of heaven was going to the Hackney Empire as often as she could afford it and taking me. And It was an Aladdin's cave. And she kept saying, E. Donald, because she came from Sunderland. She went from Russia to London. And she would say, E. Donald, look at those chandeliers. Look at the red plush carpets. And E. look at him in a dinner suit. And it was just unbelievable. And it was the same with the Regal Cinema. We would go to see the Jolson story. And I was immediately taken with all this glamour. I mean, I suppose it's escape, really, but I didn't look on it as escape. And all these songs that had names, American names in them, like California, Here I Come, I Left My Heart in Avalon, Nothing Could Be Finer Than to Be in Carolina, Swanee. And here I was in Wells Street, Hackney, you know.
So it struck something in you even
then,
did
it? Oh, it was jazz. And even the songs of the time, you know, you heard things like Moonlight in Vermont, and you thought, what is this world of all Vermont and Swanee River. And
but you knew you wanted to be part of it?
Well, I just fell in love with it. And I saw, like, the Jolson story 32 times. You know, we all did, all our family did.
Because you had lots of brothers and sisters.
I had two brothers, I still have two brothers and two sisters. And nearby there was a well-known singer of the day called Steve Conway. Some of your listeners may know he had a very big hit called Good Luck, Good Health, God Bless You. And every time he walked past the street, my mother would say, "Hey, Donald, it's Steve Conway, look, he's got a camel coat on." Because it was sort of, obviously, wealth was something we had no part of.
What about at school, though? Were you already a wordsmith? Did you enjoy all of that?
No, I remember my earliest recollection about words, but really it was to do with songs. I remember listening to the radio and listening to that marvellous Larry Hart lyric, which is 10 Cents a Dance, and there's a wonderful internal rhyme in there. And sometimes I feel I've found my hero, but it's a queero manse. It's a marvellous, clever. I thought, well, what's that? You know, and certain songs at the time was Cry Me a River, Told Me Love Was Too Plebeian, Told Me You Were Through With Me, and Now You Say You Love Me. And I used to say, what does plebeian mean? And in Noel Coward's song, Mad About the Boy, this odd diversity of misery and joy, I'd rush to the dictionary. What does diversity mean? And at school, I would go to my English teacher, Mr. King, and say, what does ubiquitous mean? And of course, my brothers would say, there's something wrong with Donald. What's the matter with him? He's always asking about words. So I've always been interested in words and vocabulary. I have no idea why.
Record number three.
Well, record number three involves my great friend, Matt Monro, who I owe so much to. He was one of the best singers ever to come out of this country. And the song I've chosen is a little-known Sammy Kahn song from a very little-known Broadway show called Skyscraper. And it's called I'll Only Miss Her When I Think of Her. And if any would-be singers are listening, they should listen to Matt's breath control, because they can then tell me if he had three lungs or not.
I'll only miss her when I think of her, and I'll think of her all the time.
Matt Monro and I'll Only Miss Her When I Think of Her. Matt Monro, whom you knew when he was still on the buses,
Yes, I knew Matt. We staffed together. He was on the buses and I was a struggling song plugger in Denmark Street. And he was just a wonderful man. I often think of Matt because if I've ever got anything that's important coming up, you know, like an interview or something that's a bit nerve-wracking, I always think, well, what Matt would say, oh, what does it all mean, son? His attitude was like that. When he was performing in Las Vegas, and I would be with him, and I'd say, Matt, you know, Sinatra's out front tonight, Liberace's out front, you know, shall I bring them round for a cup of coffee or a drink? And he would say, can't we have a game of pontoon, son? You know? And he meant it, you know, he had...
He was as relaxed as his voice.
Yeah, he wasn't impressed by any of the trappings.
You had your first big hit with him, though, didn't you? Walk
I did,
Away.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, it was Matt was in the Eurovision Song Contest, and he loved a tune. He heard a tune called Varum Nur Varum, and he said to me, "You're always on about lyrics." He said, "Why don't you have a go? If Lionel Bart can do it, you can." And that was his attitude to everything. And I took this home, and I thought, I wrote the song Walk Away, and I thought, well, hang on a minute, this is very brave, Walk Away, because it's Walk Away, Please Go Before You Throw Your Life Away. It's an older man and a younger girl, and I thought, you know, is it too deep and is it too... Anyway, it came out right in the middle of all the Beatles stuff, or just as that was starting.
The early 60s.
Early 60s. And it was a huge hit, it was a top five hit, and it was a kind of song that people noticed. John Barry, I'm pleased to say, noticed it, the composer, and asked me to do various movie things.
Thunderball, wasn't it?
Thunderball was the first one, yes. Mm. And Diamonds Are Forever and Born Free. And Born Free was the main one. But as a result of Walk Away, all kinds of doors opened for me.
But before all that, just to, let's back up for a second. You were an office boy at the New Musical
Express. I was an
Express.
Office boy, yes.
But the heart of Tin Pan Alley, that's the
yes,
point, isn't it?
That's Denmark right. Street. It was Denmark Street. It was in the eye of the storm. It was the greatest time to be anywhere. You cannot imagine it. Someone once called Denmark Street 200 yards of hokum. And I think it's just a wonderful thing because it was at the time when everyone was a songwriter down that street, or a music publisher, or a performer. And you'd get people like Dickie Valentine, who was very big. Billy Eckstein from America used to come down a lot. And I was surrounded by people like Tolchard Evans, who wrote Lady of Spain, Michael Carr, who wrote South of the Border, and all these, Jimmy Kennedy, who wrote Red Sails in the Sunset. My whole life was surrounded by songwriters. I used to think, well, these people are professional dreamers, really, which is what I wanted to be. Just the idea of just walking around a park dreaming of song titles was very appealing.
So that really was quite brave of you then to set out to be one of them.
It was. I mean, I needed a push. I needed a hit to get me started. I needed Walk Away to get going, and then Tom Jones with Thunderball. And all of a sudden I started getting busy, because when you come from Hackney, you feel very uncertain about giving anything up, you know, so I wouldn't give up a job or anything. It took me a long time to be a fully, you know, professional songwriter, where I could just rely on that.
Next record.
My next record is by a man called Jake Thackeray, who I have to say I think is one of the most unsung heroes. He is so underrated. And in the business, people think Jake Thackeray is a brilliant poet. Some people have called him a Noel Coward, In his way. He's the words he chooses are so different to anyone else. In the opening lines, it says, now we're in love, we'll have to face the la-di-da, the eyewash. You think, where did that come from, the eyewash?
Now we're agreed that we're in love, we'll have to face the la-di-da, the eyewash, all of the fancy pantomime. I love you very much, I'll try, love, I'll bill and coo with your gruesome Auntie Susan. I'll stay calm, I'll play it cool.
Jake Thackeray and La-Di-Da. So, Don Black, you got the Oscar for Born Free when you were about 28, but as you say, you still didn't become a full-time lyricist until you were about 36, I think. What did you do in between time?
Well, in between time, I wrote a hell of a lot of songs. You've got to remember, when I won that Oscar, I wasn't quite sure how important that Oscar was. I never forget, when I did win it, I came back after Dean Martin gave it to me, and in the hotel they were all standing up applauding, and it was very nice. But it's not until I phoned my sister in London, and she said, well, it's on the placards, the Evening Standard, it's got East End Boy Wins Oscar, you know. I didn't realise exactly what it meant, and I was also insecure, I think, even with that Oscar. And so I liked the business end of the business. And so I went in with NEMS, which was Brian Epstein's company. And he said I could write my songs and manage people, which I enjoyed. I was managing Matt Monro, of course. But I was looking after people like Johnny Mathis and Nat King Cole, Andy Williams when they came here. So, again, I just liked being around those sort of people.
But all people who sang other people's songs.
Yes. Well, of course, that is the thing, and that is a very good point you mentioned there, because this, when you talk about great performers, they all have one thing in common. They didn't write songs. If you look at Fred Astaire, Lena Horne, Streisand, Nat Cole, whoever your favourite, Sammy Davis Jr., they were not songwriters. They were performers and entertainers. And I think that, you know, and these days, of course, all the big stars write their own songs. It's a hell of a strain for a record company to sign somebody who doesn't write, because they have to find the material for them. So if they find a singer-songwriter, it's self-contained.
And it means, of course, that Tin Pan Alley, as you were describing it just now, doesn't really exist anymore, does it?
Tin Pan Alley, no. I mean, in those days, everyone knew everyone. You must remember, everyone knew everyone. Now, today, it wouldn't surprise me if Sting had never met Bruce Springsteen at all. I mean, they don't have to meet. But there was a centre. I do miss that feeling of togetherness.
Well, it's also a kind of creative thing, isn't it? When lots of people come together who are all creative,
that's right,
somehow something else happens. Whereas if they're all sitting in their millionaires' row houses, yes, doing it by themselves.
That's why I like musicals, because it's very collaborative. And, you know, you're all together, the choreographers, directors, designers, and it's that feeling of working on something together. I mean, it's a very lonely business.
Tell me about that moment, though, that can't be lonely, when you actually sit down with somebody you regard as great, and he or she sings your song for the first time.
Well, it is thrilling. I mean, it's some things you can't put a price on. When you actually hear Barbara Streisand sing a song of yours, it's what you dream of all your life, for a songwriter to have Streisand, who's one of the greatest interpreters of a song.
Because you persuaded her, didn't you, to record With One Look from Sunset Boulevard before the show came out?
Yes, I wouldn't say persuaded. I think she heard the two songs, and I went to her house in Beverly Hills and spent a whole afternoon with her, hours and hours, and we dismantled the songs together. She goes over every comma and crotchet, and she is a perfectionist, but she's a lovely, lovely lady. And in the middle of it all, she's making cups of tea and talking about her life. And when she sings, of course, I mean, it's like liquid diamond.
More music.
Well, I've chosen a song written by Julie Stein and Stephen Sondheim from the musical Gypsy. And some of the greatest times of my life has been watching Broadway shows. And this song just sums up the excitement of an opening night on Broadway. It's Julie Stein at his best and Liza Minnelli giving it all she's got.
Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. That's okay for some people who don't know they're alive. Some people can thrive and bloom, living life in the living room. That's perfect for some people of what 105, but I at least got a try when I think of
Liza Minnelli singing Some People. So it was 1974, actually, Don, with the musical Billy, that you became a full-time writer, and that was a great success. It ran at Drury Lane. It was based on Keith Waterhouse's Billy Lyre, as we know. It makes it all look and sound very easy. You know, you wrote a few songs and you went on and then you wrote a musical. It ain't that easy, is it, because you've had some flops as well. Tell me about your flops.
Well, you haven't got time. But well, my flops. Let's talk about my flops. Right, the first flop I had was, I think, a musical called Dear Anyone, which was about an agony aunt. It starred Jane Lapertaire, and I wrote it with a man called Jeff Stevens, a lovely songwriter who wrote songs like Winchester Cathedral and There's a Kind of Hush All Over the World. Book was by Jack Rosenthal, and it wasn't terrible. And we had a big hit song from it called I'll Put You Together Again, Hot Chocolate. But it was predictable. When you know you're doing a musical about an agony aunt, you know going in that she can solve everybody's problems but her own. Mm. So that didn't work. I did a musical, Budgie, with Adam Faith and Anita Dobson. That didn't work. That was an unhappy experience. I thought it was a good idea, Budgie, because I thought it was Soho in the 60s, Keith Waterhouse, Adam and Anita. It just seemed right. But I'll tell you what was wrong with it, which is interesting. It seemed very old-fashioned. I mean, it was a bit sleazy. It was strippers, and I don't think people want that.
But it's interesting, isn't it, because all the ingredients would have seemed to have been there. I mean, and there are many other famous flops too, aren't there? I mean, Danny Kaye and Richard Rodgers failed with Two by Two.
Yeah, but that's one of the great things. Alan J. Lerner, who wrote My Fair Lady, Camelot, Paint Your Wagon, he also wrote Coco Chanel, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue about the White House, Dance a Little Closer. I could go on about Alan's flops. And he used to just say, hey ho.
Is there a recipe for success? I suppose there isn't really. You've got, even if it's a small story, you've got to have a universal theme, haven't you?
I think a universal theme helps a great deal. But, you know, Sol Hurok, the great American showman, said a wonderful thing. If people don't want to see a show, nothing will stop them. And I think that's so true. You can't make people go to a theatre. It's word of mouth at the end of the day. It happens.
Is it? But, I mean, you've got to have, as we say, this universal theme. You've got to have a good story, a good book, even if it's sung through or whatever. Have you got to have big stars?
You certainly don't need big stars because Phantom of the Opera is packing them in all the time and no one knows who's in it when they buy their ticket. They go to see Phantom, not the person in it. And it's the same with Evita and Les Mis. People go to Les Mis. And it's interesting with shows like Les Mis and Miss Saigon because these are shows that don't really have hit songs in them either, which is unusual because Richard Rodgers always used to talk about take-home songs. But I once interviewed the writers of Les Mis and Miss Saigon, and they said, well, they take home shows, they don't take home songs.
But what it all proves is it's a completely unpredictable business. You've just got to keep trying and trying.
It's very difficult. I once compared it with doing your own root canal work. It is that difficult.
That painful?
That painful, yes.
Record number 6.
Well, this song is a lovely song written by a man called Mac Gordon. You'd know many of his other songs, like The More I See You. He's written some wonderful songs, but this song is lovely because it's an unusual story. It's about a woman who's in love with someone she shouldn't be in love with. It's called My Heart Tells Me.
Will I be sorry if I do? Should I believe my heart or you?
Susanna McCorkle and My Heart Tells Me. You say, Don Black, that most singers these days write their own songs. Why don't you write your own music?
Because there's so many people who can do it better. I couldn't do it. I mean, I could write a predictable pedestrian tune. I think everyone could.
But do you understand music? I mean, do you know what Andrew Lloyd Webber means when he says, we'll move into B-flat now?
I sense it. I sort of, it's instinctive rather than know.
Do you play an instrument at all?
No.
So you just sit down with a paper and pencil?
That's right.
The music's in your head. Well, you've got it written down in sheet music.
Yes, but I don't try and play it because it would be awful. It'd be very off-putting. No, I just listen to it on a cassette. Andrew would play me the melody on a cassette and I'd learn it. And then I'd just walk around the park and think about it. It's a lot of thinking time.
Mm. What about singing? Why don't you sing your own songs?
I know. I wish I could sing too as well. But then, I don't know, I shouldn't complain.
You shouldn't complain because, as I understand it, you don't even need to work anymore. I mean, you know, the old royalties roll in and you're, you know, happy.
Well, I think you do. First of all, I don't think it's anything to do with needing. I think you enjoy it. I've always loved writing songs. I would never stop. If I won the lottery, it wouldn't make any difference. I'd still be writing songs.
How often do you write one?
I thought you were going to say, how often do you do the lottery? Well, I write usually when I'm asked, but I'm often scribbling down ideas. I have books full of thoughts, thinking, well, that's a good idea. One day that'll come in handy.
Can I ask you the impossible question? Which piece that you've written are you proudest of? Or is there one line or a whole song?
It's always a very difficult thing. I like odd bits and pieces. There's a song I wrote for Michael Jackson called Ben. I like the middle section of that, which Michael Jackson liked the best, because it says it in as few words as you can. And it says, I used to say I and me, now it's us, now it's we. Which says a lot in as few notes as possible.
Record number 7.
Record number 7, yes. Now, I love country music, and because as opposed to the lyric writing that goes on Broadway, which is all to do with polished lyrics, it's very unpolished there. It's all about raw emotion. And I spent some time in Nashville, and everyone is looking for titles. Everyone's a songwriter down in Nashville. If you say hello to them, they say, hey, what a great title, you know. But I'd like to, you know, have been there when this guy wrote this title, because I think it really is a terrific one. You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille.
You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille, with 4 hungry children and crops in the field. I've had some bad times, lived through some sad times, but this time the hurting won't heal. You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille.
Kenny Rogers and Lucille. Tell me about Don Black on a desert island. There must be inspiration for a few songs there.
Well, I don't know. Probably things like Yellow Bird Up High in Banana Tree or something like that. But
Sort of Girl from Ipanema or something.
Yes.
You could imagine.
I could imagine all that. I don't, funny enough, I can. I've taught myself to write anywhere, in kitchens, on streets. It doesn't matter where I write because it's all in your head. It's that mind-wandering lunacy. So I don't think it matters where you are. I don't think I'd be great on this desert island. So, I mean, it sounds marvellous, but I'm not very good as a handyman. I'm not very good as a cook. I don't think I'd be a great survivor there. I mean, I'd love it for a few hours. I love the idea of it.
But are you a great reflector? I mean, would you sit there and, I don't know, reflect on the nature of your success or...
Well, they say it is always nice to reflect on your achievements instead of looking ahead about what may happen. It's a thing people should do, you know. And I think that is nice because I think everyone tries very hard and they never stop to look what's happened so far. Yes, I would reflect. I just I'd like to get out of there pretty soon, though.
Write yourself a nice take-home song.
That's right.
What about? Let me just ask you finally about your parents. I mean, we were saying that your mother was so starstruck. Did she live to enjoy your success for itself?
Well, she did to a certain extent. She was there for a few of them, but unfortunately, she died just before my Oscar, which I thought was a terrible, terrible tragedy. But she was there, and just the fact that I knew people like Matt Monro, who she heard on the radio, she was happy. She didn't have to meet Sinatra. She was quite happy to meet the fella down the road who sang in a local pub. She was quite happy to meet anyone who was just involved in this magical business.
Last record.
My last record is a duet from The Pearl Fishers by Bizet. The reason I chose this is that some songs and some music is written, but this one seems to be coming from the gods. It seems to be coming from some exalted arena, and it just takes you to the sky.
The duet Au fond du Temple Saint from The Pearl Fishers by Bizet, sung by Jussi Björling and Robert Merrill, with the RCA Victor Orchestra conducted by Renato Cellini. So, Don, if you could only take one of those eight records.
I would take the Albinoni Adagio because it would keep me busy and I'll just keep writing words.
And a book?
I've chosen a book that probably no one's heard of. It's I picked it up in America. It's called 14,000 Things to Be Happy About, and it's written by a lady called Barbara Ann Kipfer. And it's just a list, really, and it's a reminder of the small pleasures in life we all take for granted. Things like a trip to the library, the cool underside of a pillow, crayons for children in restaurants, W.C. Fields, The Wizard of Oz, window boxes, just little things like that that would remind me of life back wherever.
Keep you happy. I think you are just a happy person, aren't you? I don't know whether you need to be kept happy.
I like to think I have a sunny disposition. I'm not really aware of it until I look at other people and I think, well, compared to other people... Well,
I think how miserable they are.
No.
What about your luxury?
Well, I've always been a great snooker enthusiast, so I would have a snooker table. Whenever I play snooker for a couple of hours, I forget about everything. Just how do I get that white ball back here? You know, it's just another small pleasure.
Don Black, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.